Testing, 1, 2, 3. She knew what a roboseat was. Well, it happened she had a school chum, I guess in high school, whose father fixed up a Ford, had a roboseat, and
she didn't have a roboseat. It was just a
marble. Okay, anyway, a roboseat was how it worked was you had a car, and there was like usually, I think, two seaters, the driver and the passenger. And that was covered like a regular car with a roof. And then in the back, instead of a trunk for luggage, you had, it opened up and there was a seat back there, kind of like a couch, if you will, only leatherette or something. And you could sit out there and then you could drive, and that person was almost like in a convertible. Well, that's what a rumble seat was. And I just wanted to record that I think I've ridden in a rumble seat. I asked my friend, who's my local car expert, when did rumble seats end or whatever, because they were way back. And he, in fact, said he had a car, I think, with a rumble seat, but he thinks maybe rumble seats ended like in maybe 1936 or something like that. In any case, it's kind of interesting. Think rumble seats. P.S. to rumble seats. My friend said rumble seats were absolutely made for necking. They were the perfect place to neck. It was just really, really great. So think about that. The never-ending Titanic story. You know, we had some kin. I said some kin, I think, in the earlier time. That was on the Titanic. Well, it happened, now I have a little bit more information. The family, the O'Neills, O'Neill was a cousin that was, my father's had a cousin who was an O'Neill, okay? The person that was on the Titanic, I always assumed, I guess, I don't know, didn't know any better, whatever, was Mrs. O'Neill and her husband, Mr. O'Neill. But as a matter of fact, that's not true. I guess she was on the Titanic, and I guess she was like 16 years old, and she was coming over to the United States on her own, by herself, a young Irish girl. I guess, you know, certainly not married at 16. And so she was the one that lived through the Titanic, and then she came to the States and somehow got to New Jersey and Jersey City and settled there, and so that's that aspect of the Titanic. Now my brother told me this story, a little story about the O'Neills. He was a plumber. That's the first thing. I clearly remember he was a plumber, and I remember being a kid and being amazed at this tool, which somehow he demonstrated would cut the end of a pipe, and then you could attach another pipe to it. Anyway, I can picture that. He said, my brother said, he remembers the two of us going over to the O'Neills and maybe having lunch every day for some period of time, like a week. And he wasn't sure why, and he wondered maybe our mother was in the hospital having Paula or something like that. He didn't remember. And I don't remember this at all either, us going there. Although I do remember being at their home. I tell you what, I can remember their kitchen pretty good, and I can remember their dining room pretty well. But my brother said, you know, what they drank there, he said they didn't drink milk. He said they drank a tea mixed with a lot of milk and a lot of sugar. And it was funny, he said this, I absolutely can remember drinking that O'Neill Irish beverage, tea with lots of milk and lots of sugar. And it's funny how, after all these years, you can remember that. Now, it was at the O'Neills that I was out in the garden, in the back garden, and I remember seeing the Hindenburg. I looked up in the air, and there was the Hindenburg. I have a very clear memory of this, and I even have romanticized this Hindenburg thing, and I saw the Hindenburg on its last flight. Now, I don't know if I did, but it makes a good story. But I really did see the Hindenburg Zeppelin on its way to Lakehurst, New Jersey, carrying passengers. That's a great story. On the 4th of July, I don't remember when, but I was a little kid, we went to the O'Neills, I guess the whole family, I don't remember much about this, and they was doing firecrackers and cherry bombs and all that business. And somebody blew up a cherry bomb, which was a little, I guess one inch around, we would call them M81s now, I suppose. Really piece of explosive business. And this thing, I think this is what did it, I'm pretty sure. It exploded and it blew a piece of actual shrapnel into my left leg. I have a scar on my leg to this day. I haven't looked at it, I haven't even noticed it in years and years, but I bet it's an inch across. I was really like shot. I mean, if you think about it, I was absolutely shot. And of course, everybody went hysterical over this. I suppose me too. I don't remember any of that. But I was a little guy. I remember that. Now remember, my father never owned a car and he didn't drive. Now I don't think O'Neill's had a car and I don't know that they drove, as far as I know. In any case, I remember, you can just see this scene. It must have been just absolutely hysteria. But I remember my father taking me, wrapped in a blanket, and carrying me some distance to a hospital to get this wound cut up, you know, stitched up or whatever. I don't remember being... I remember him carrying me, and this was, of course, one of the great trauma events. And I still have the scar. It looks like a bullet scar, and essentially that's what it is. Somewhere in the 1970s, I don't remember the year, but I would suppose it was probably in the mid-70s, Washington State University at Pullman, Washington advertised an art history position was open, and I applied. And in fact, I was tailor-made for the job. The job description and what they wanted to teach, that was me. I just knew that. In any case, I applied for the job, and they, sure enough, they invited me down to interview. So we went there. Now, WSU at that time, and probably today, was at least the various departments, like the art department, was this really little, ingrown, narrow group of fully tenured guys that had been there forever, and
I was invited, we stayed at, I think at a motel, but we were invited for supper when we went over there to the chair's place, so, you know, so everybody could examine me and smell me and all that. That's a typical higher ed activity. But in any case, the chair of the department said to me something like this, just sort of casual discussion. He said, "Do you like home fried potatoes?" Oh, I said, "Oh yeah, that's, you know, you're trying to get along, go along." Yeah, I said, "Oh yes, I like home fried potatoes." Well, he said, "I have to tell you something." He said, "In Pullman, Washington, there's a woman named, like, Lila, and she is the home fried potato cook of the entire world." Now, he said, "She is so good, she moves around from one restaurant to the other." He said, you have to keep track of her, but her home fries are, like, incredible. He said, "Now, presently, she's cooking at the Garland Cafe and Eatery over there on 12th Street. Now, if you want to go have some most incredible, you said you liked home fries, you got to try these." Well, sort of, stupidly locked into this thing. Right? So the next morning we woke up in my hometown. I said to Margo, "We just got to go track down this home fried potato person." And sure enough, we drove all from Hill to Breakfast. See, that's 11th and it joins in the Pullman and you gotta go with a right turn here, you know, that kind of thing. And we finally found this restaurant, you know, and went in and we had breakfast there, you know. We'll have poached eggs and home fried potatoes. And they came, and of course, as every listener knows, they were just like really ordinary home fried potatoes. They were just home fried potatoes. Now, I never knew, and don't know to this day, whether this guy was jerking me around and whether he, you know, I think it really would be clever if he told all the other faculty, "I'm going to do the home fried potato routine on this turkey and see what he does, you know. I'll tell him about this and he's going to be an ass kisser and go around and find this potato cook and all of it." I don't know that I'm probably too conspiratorial. But anyway, I did felt obligated the next day when I went back for the job interview to I had some home fried potatoes over there, you know, wherever. I said, "They were pretty good." "Oh," he said, I knew you'd love them. They're the absolutely the home fried potato capital of the world, you know, that kind of thing." Well, I think the point of this story is, like, it's stupid. It's a pointless story. How you can get, so maybe the point is how you can get trapped into something like that. I didn't get the job. A woman got the job, and of course a woman got the job because that's politically correct now, and white guys are discriminated against, and they're put down and shoved aside and degraded and screwed over and that kind of thing. And I've learned to accept that in the end. I do remember a tiny little mistake I made. Now, they had a man who taught art history there, and I, of course, was applying for an art history position. It seems to me his name was MacArthur, although he was, in fact, a Japanese guy, but I may be mistaking about his name. It's not important in any case. But he loved to go to France. On every summer, he went to France and studied some who knows what, you know, cathedral or whatever. And he prided himself on collecting obscure, wonderful French liqueurs. And he had some there. And in fact, I think the party was, that evening event was held at his home. Not the chairs, but his home. So he said, I want you to taste this. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but take a little sip of this. And oh, I said, oh, God, that's gorgeous. I said, it just has the taste of ripe pears. Oh, yes, you're right. Oh, God. Yes, exactly. It's this pear liqueur that's from this obscure village in southern France. Okay, take the second one. And I tasted that. I said, oh. You know, I can taste the lush taste of crab apple. Not regular apple, but crab apple. It's that kind of little off taste of apple. Oh God. He was ecstatic. Oh, that's wonderful. You know, I want to try one more. Now, I have to tell you a little story. I visited a crony of mine in South Carolina, I guess. And Sunday morning, he took me around. He said, let's get my car. He had an Oldsmobile 88. And we drove around to visit Ken and do different things. He wanted to show me where he went swimming as a kid in this old swimming hole and that kind of thing. Well, he visited some uncle or something. I don't know who he was. His name was Ben Red. I love that name. Ben Red, I heard from him years later, was murdered. Now, that's I'm not inventing that. That's a true story. Well, we went to Ben Red's place, and Ben Red, this was like, I don't know, 11 o'clock in the morning. Well, Ben Red was already drinking moonshine liquor. And he really was, this is not an exaggeration, he was drinking this out of a fruit jar. Now, and there was nothing. All right, everybody, sit down, have a drink, you know, and they're passing this fruit jar around, and this stuff tastes. I'll tell you what I thought moonshine tasted like to me. It tasted like an alcoholic drink in which you took a big vat of alcohol and then put into it a bunch of chopped up old galoshes and hip boots. This really has a gross taste, but it's a distinguished taste. It tastes like old hip boots. And anyway, that's how I know this taste from visiting Ben Redner's trailer. In any case, back to Pullman, Washington, this guy, again, his name was MacArthur, he said, now I want you to try the third one. He said, this is really, I want you to really savor this and tell me. And I took a sip of it, and then I made one of those career mistakes. I said to him, this tastes like moonshine whiskey to me. Well, his eyes glazed over, and I realized my career at WSU was never going to germinate. I was finished, nipped in the bud as Now, I want to tell you now that we're on this WSU story, I want to tell you something. We wouldn't have moved to WSU on a dare. I mean, if they had said, okay, Quentin, we're going to pay you the same amount as a vice president, and you only have to teach one class every 3 years. Honestly, we thought Pullman was horrible. It's not the kind of place did we want to live in. It was just really gross. And the only, and how they survived there was, they survived in these little cliques of people who had, you know, every Wednesday night pinochle and Saturday night everybody got together. It's that kind of thing, I suspect. I made a terrible mistake at Pullman, and my mistake was, I knew I wouldn't take the job. I didn't give a damn whether they offered to me or not. And a mistake I made, I wanted to be a pig. And I want to tell you, pigs don't make money. Bears make money, bulls make money, pigs don't.
what I wanted them, I knew this job was for me. I knew I was fully qualified. I was the person they were looking for. Needless to say, I didn't know there's a woman out there in the bushes. And I wanted them to offer me this job so I could turn it down. Because I wouldn't have taken it. I absolutely would have not taken this job. And that was my mistake. I was being picky. Instead of saying to these guys, we said, well, you know, we could have had this meeting, you know. Well, gee, Quentin, thanks a lot for coming here to WSU and blah, blah, blah. And they say, and I could have then said, you know, guys, I have to tell you something. I don't want the job. I don't want to work it here. I'm real sorry. It's not my kind of place. I know you're wonderful people. And I didn't. I wanted to be picky. I wanted them to offer me the job so I could turn it down. Well, they didn't offer me the job, so I couldn't turn it down. So that, don't be picky, if I could give you some advice. P.S. Now, what's the strangest thing about this WSU thing at Pullman? And there's no way you could have predicted this. It's so strange. I just have never really totally understood it myself. I mean, there are like, I don't know, 1,800 universities in the country. Some good, some bad. But as a matter of fact, Cindy and Kathy are graduates of WSU. Can you believe this? No, I can't believe this. This is so weird, but it's true. It's absolutely true. They are both graduates of Washington State University. One final report. We visited, I don't remember, once or twice perhaps, but maybe more, I don't remember. We visited Kathy while she attended WSU, and she lived with a really weird roommate, and I don't remember a lot about her, although I think she's presently the president of like AT&T, but in any case, every suspicion about Pullman was confirmed when we visited Kathy. It is it's the end of the world. It's a horrible place. Why would anybody live there? I have no idea. But we did visit her, and we loved seeing her, but we just fled the town. Now, you know, I just had my 69th birthday, and Paula sent me a present. And it happened that we conversed on the telephone before I got the present. And she asked me a question. She said, do you remember the Morgan Bank story and the bombing thing? And I said, yes, I do. And this is my, now, how do I remember this? I don't know, but I remember hearing this story. That somebody, anarchist, that's who did these kind of things years ago. When was it done? I have no idea, but I suppose in the 20s or something. Anarchist planted a bomb outside the Morgan Bank and blew it up. This bomb blew up and I don't know, you know, 12 killed and all that kind of thing. Well, anyway, Morgan, this is a story as I remember it. Morgan decided that he would not repair the damage from the bomb on the building. He insisted the bomb damage, you know, chipping out the concrete or marble or whatever it was, he would not repair that. He wanted that to be a sort of testimonial that you can't blow up the Morgan Bank. Now, I suppose one could visit New York City and walk around the Morgan Bank and see if there are, in fact, chips still missing from the bank. I said to Paula, this is a sort of little truth or truism. I said, you know, I always thought about the Morgan Bank, and for years, I've always wanted to own some shares in Morgan Bank. It's Morgan Bank is in the Dow, you know. It's and it's like one of the banks. And I said, I've never owned Morgan Bank shares, stocks, but it just seemed to me to be just, I don't know, some sort of symbolic kind of thing. In any case, she said, well, I'm sending you a present, and this present will remind you of that story. And I suppose maybe it did. Well, the present was, it was from, it was a bag of tea, and then a little tea strainer and a little tea, I don't know what you even, I'm sure they have a name, tea cup that you put the strain, tea strainer holder, I guess. And she bought it at the Pierpoint Morgan Library, which is where they have it. They have one of the most incredible Titian paintings absolutely in the world there. Maybe the best Titian ever painted. It's like, ooh. And of course, Titian was like beyond mere mortal man. He was an incredible painter. They also own a really famous manuscript and it escapes me. Among other things, they own, that library owns everything. And then, in any case, Paula sent me this. And then she put a little note in it, and I have to tell you, Paula speaks in tongues often, at least as far as I can see. So she's an incredibly good letter writer, but again, she talks in tongues. And she put this little note in there, and here's what the little note said. Well, if Mama had her way, this building would be owned by all of us. Happy, happy Paula. Now, I have no idea what that means. This is a mystery note. I mean, are we saying if my mother had been alive, she would think that this bank, was she some kind of a communist, or what is this? The Pierpoint Morgan Library would be owned by everybody? I have no idea what this note means. And Paula is like, that's one fun thing about Paula, is she's sort of a mystery. But the point is that Paula asked me, did I remember the story about the bank and the bomb and all that, and I did. Where did I hear that story and all that? Who knows? P.S. of the Morgan Bank bombing. I wonder if the bomb had been, instead of a bomb being planted by two absolutely, totally incompetent, let's say, European anarchists from, like, Bulgaria, suppose the Morgan Bank had met Tim McVeigh, homegrown bomber. One could wonder about whether the bank would have been repaired or... how would that work out? I have no idea. We have to think about that. Lesser known fact about the Titanic. The Titanic actually was owned by Morgan. It was the Titanic... was owned by the United States, by an American. It was not owned by a Brit. Now, I don't think till this movie came out many people knew that. I certainly didn't. Given the propensity we have for reading food labels, I was sitting here eating, I suppose, one of the forbidden breakfasts in America now, French toast made with real eggs. Anyway. No, nobody eats that anymore. Well, hardly, I guess. But I was looking, just as Americans do now, and reading the back of the syrup label, and it was, you know, nutritive things. And well, at the very top it said Log Cabin, and I realized that name has been around a long time. Log Cabin syrup is, you know, just a name that's been with us. So I turned the jar around. The jar is plastic, of course. And it said, a family tradition since 1887. So that's how long Log Cabin syrup has been around. It, by the way, when I was a child, and I don't know how long after that, it came in a tin can shaped like a log cabin. It was just, well, it came like in a can shaped like a log cabin. We went to the grocery Safeway today and bought some odds and ends, as one does. And Margo bought some daffodils, and they're here at our supper table tonight. We finished eating. And I remarked to Margo, well, you know, she's bought daffodils every spring since we've been here, like, I don't know what, 25 or 30 years. And she said, yeah, and she said, you know, I used to buy, and this is a true story, and when she said it, I realized it was true, that she, even when we didn't have a lot of money, and that was a fair amount of our early married life, we didn't have a lot of money, she could always manage 99 cents or whatever it was to buy a little bunch of daffodils and bring them home. And so it's true, we've always had flowers, and I've always loved that. I don't know, what can I say? Flowers bring joy to one's life, I guess. Did I mention that right now Margo is growing a Mrs. Stewart's Blueing / Salt Rock Crystal Garden? Now, she grew these with the girls years and years ago, and I always thought the secret was a piece of coal, but apparently, and in fact, I think she grew them on coal. I thought that was like article one of doing these things, but apparently grow them on all sorts of other things, and I talked to Cindy about it, and she said she grew them with Emma on charcoal. And I said, well, that makes sense. And now Margo's trying to grow them on a sponge, although she's not having a great deal of success, although it's my old sponge, it may be too soapy or something. So we'll keep everyone informed on the Mrs. Stewart's guaranteed original Crystal Garden, I guess. What can I say? Yeah. You know, one of the problems with doing all these tapes is one never remembers if, did I talk about this or not? But one of my absolutely great regrets in my life was we took a train to Newcastle, and we had